Good evening. Welcome to another edition of the Shabbat Torah study. Kirk and JB and myself will be setting in because Craig is busily moving still. How's everybody doing?
Everybody, I'm fine.
Good.
At my end, so how are you doing?
I'm good. It's all good over there. Hi, Cherie. I see she's saying hello. Last week I thought we had a pretty good show when we were talking about, you know, what it was that really got us to start questioning, you know, the lies and, you know, through the religious traditions and things like that that we'd all been taught. I was probably ahead of most because I was actually raised by atheists. And I knew that was a bad position as well.
Mm-hmm.
Just that's to the point of delusion. It's just another form of a religion. You know, let's be all, you know, man's going to save the day. When it's the exact opposite. But last week, JB, your phone was, you were having a hard time with your connection, and you didn't really get to chime in on that subject. So I'd like to set back, if it's all right with Kirk, and listen to
Absolutely.
Why it is
no,
you began to question religious beliefs. Or I guess you were more on the atheist / agnostic side, but, you know, why you, what drew you to the truth? What was it?
I was raised not really atheist, but my parents were not very religious. It was kind of a nominal Christian household. Yeah, the way I told people, you know, my dad's family's Catholic, my mom's family's Lutheran. So if religion had been important to either one of them, I would not exist, because Lutherans and Catholics don't tend to get along.
Mm-hmm.
So that was how I was raised, and I would kind of grow up with the nominal Christian, you know, yeah, I believe Jesus died, blah, 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 Easter, Christmas, all right. But it was about 13 or 14, I kind of just started abandoning all that because I got into a phase where I was real big on, like, Egyptian mythology and then Greek mythology, Norse mythology. I loved all the stories. Not really believing in the pantheons or following any of that, but just the stories were fun and interesting. But I kind of noticed, you know, as a kid, you know, teenager, you know, all those are really kind of the same thing, different names, slightly different stories. But, you know, you start seeing all the same things, and then you see all that same stuff coming into Christianity. And so it was like all this, you know, Christmas and all this. This is all clearly just pagan rehashing. So, yeah, I just kind of completely abandoned Christianity at that point and was agnostic and, you know, at times bordered to atheism. There was that kind of rebellious teenage thing that was like, you know, all these people believe in God. They're stupid. I'm smarter than them. I'm not going to believe in God. So went through that phase. And then I kind of reached a point as I got more mature and older and early mid-20s probably, and kind of started more questioning became more the agnostic. You're just like, yeah, there may be a God, who knows, I can't say for sure, but yeah, I wasn't interested in researching it too much either, so. And it really kind of, for me, started just by an accident. I was flipping through, I had my headphones on, listening to talk radio like I did while I was at college, and I was between classes, and I'm flipping through, and I happened to flip on and catch an interview with Gerald Schroeder talking about the science of God. And I listened to that for about an hour between classes one day and was like, well, this guy is making a lot of sense. You know, going up, you know, most of it was over the creation account. And so I went and bought his books, and where in Science of God, he lines up the creation account with relativity and the outline of the story and how it's, you know, scientifically speaking, what's described in time, quote unquote, the Bible was, you know, lined up perfectly with it. So that was kind of an eye opener for me in terms of, you know, okay, well, maybe there is some validity to this Bible. Maybe, you know, it's not all junk. And that's when I started doing more and more studying. It was around that same time I heard Craig on a radio show doing an interview for Prophet of Doom, so I read through Prophet of Doom. And, you know, it was right around that same time, you know, it all kind of happened at one time, over about 3-4 month period. I clicked over to yada yada and, you know, started reading the beginning chapters of that, which a lot were influenced by, echoed the Science of God. So I was listening to, we were reading that, and that I kind of clicked in that, you know, this Yada Yada book had some validity because it was, you know, reaffirming what I'd read there and went more in depth. And kind of went from there and read through that two, three times in the course of about 3 months. Loved the, at the time I was a pizza delivery driver, so I spent the majority of my time in a car, so I downloaded all the chapters that had audio version, and I would just listen to those over and over because, like, the way my mind works is, you know, I'd be listening to it, I'd hear something, and my mind would, you know, completely tone out the rest of what I was listening to while it's thinking about this one thing, and so then the next time I'd listen to it, I'd catch something that I missed before because I was thinking about it. So listening to it over and over just kind of helped, you know, pick up all these different things. And, you know, everything just started clicking. And, you know, all the stuff that I had dismissed Christianity for, you know, I realized was not anywhere in Yahweh's word. You know, Christmas, Easter, all that pagan stuff that, you know, like I said, I had noticed it related to all these mythologies. I'm like, well, that's not anywhere in here. That was all added. And what is in here makes perfect sense. You get, you know, the heaven and hell thing was like one of the biggest holdbacks for me. I could never accept a God that said, you know, love me or burn for eternity in hell. You know, especially when you consider, you know, my argument to Christians was always, well, what about some guy in a tribe in Africa who's born, you know, never heard of Jesus, you know, never heard of a Bible, you know, God's going to burn him for eternity in hell just because he lucked out and was born in this location? That just seemed kind of cruel. You know, it's, the idea was like, you know, the idea is that, you know, if a soul is eternal, then there has to be a default destination, meaning, you know, the default is either they go to heaven or they go to hell if you're using the binary system of heaven and hell. And so the Christian view is that, you know, the default is hell, so, which, you know, contradicts them who are like, you know, anytime a baby dies, well, all babies go straight to heaven. Well, where's that at? You know, why does the baby go to heaven, but the guy born over here who never heard about it, not? So, you know, coming across in Yada Yada and reading about, you know, the three doors idea, well, that makes perfect sense. You know, three destinations. You can choose to be with him, and he brings you there. You can choose nothing. And okay, you have nothing. Yeah, that the key with that was the idea of the soul being mortal, which was so contrary to anything I'd ever read, but made sense. And when you, especially if you look at the actual words, the word translated as soul from Hebrew, one of its, you know, definitions and connotations is literally mortality. The idea of an immortal soul that permeates every religion and culture, really. Which actually I found, if you really go and look at the history of that, that really dates to Greek mythology. Prior to that, there was no concept of an immortal soul, really.
Well, what about the Egyptians, though? I mean, they obviously thought the pharaoh was going to go to some land. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know what they thought the
pharaoh would actually ascend to be a god.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's true.
And that their chosen would be taken to this realm of gods. But it wasn't so much in terms of a eternal soul. You know, they actually believed that the majority of people had no afterlife, or that they had a more of like a purgatory type afterlife than a hell. But yeah, the concept of the soul itself being immortal was not relatively new. Greek, you know, Grecian philosophy isn't all that new anymore, but in relative to the span of human existence, that's really where that idea started to spread from. It's actually where it got first introduced into Judaism. If you read early Jewish writings, pre-first century, yeah, there's really no mention of immortal souls or even of heaven and hell in much degree, other than, you know, at least not in terms of the binary choice. For them, it was viewed as, you know, they didn't specifically spell out three destinations, but they spoke of heaven, they spoke of hell. Most of the time, just like in Scripture, most of the time it doesn't speak of either one, it just speaks of death. Now, that's like,
why
Scripture speaks more of death than heaven or hell.
Why do you think that the concept of heaven and hell without any middle ground, why do you think it took hold so well?
Oh, the religious love it because it's coercion. It's a carrot and stick approach.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's, you know, if you're bad, then you'll get this horrible, awful punishment. But if you're good, look what we got for you here. Yeah, you know, it's the same as, you know,
Santa
the
Claus.
United States. Well, yeah, or the United States going to these third world countries and trying to dictate policy. Yeah, we don't tell them, well, you have to do this, but it's, well, if you do this, we'll give you this foreign aid. If you don't do this, we'll attack you, or we'll take our foreign aid away. It's, you know, coercion at its core. It's carrot and stick. And so it mm-hmm. works so great for religion. If you convince people of it, see, then religion no longer has to convince you that they're right. They just have to convince you to be afraid of the fact that they're wrong. Yeah, it doesn't matter.
Well,
if
you know, the same
right.
The same people that come off with the heaven or hell nonsense story are also people that lead people into atheism because they claim that God is omnipresent. You know, like, you know, they've never considered, you know, when you look at prophecy, I guess, from a Christian standpoint, you almost have to look at it as though all these are manipulations being made by God, okay?
Mm-hmm.
You know, when, in fact, prophecy, and that goes back to the light thing, is, you know, he equates himself with being light, and that's what the spiritual realm really is, an energy-based realm. It's, you know, it's not our realm, but when you begin to look at that, you realize that what he's doing is reporting back to a person that has a pen in their hand and can hear him, and he's reporting back what he's already seen. He's not manipulating the future, and he is not omnipresent. So, you know, one of the things that I've heard many atheists say, first thing, and I'm sure you guys have both heard it,
mm-hmm.
is that, why does he allow war?
Yeah. Or horrible anything.
Yeah, yeah, right. I mean,
yeah, that's,
well,
the other thing. I hate the idea of the micromanaging.
Called free
God.
Will. Yeah, it's free will. I mean, he states that there's free will everywhere, all over his words.
He couldn't be clearer on that subject.
No, I don't think so.
Right. So thus, we don't have commands. So the commanding religious dolt of a God with, you know, really very poor judgment skills, who loves everybody. Can you imagine loving everybody? I mean, that's insane on its face. You'd have to be a madman to love everybody. So, yeah, all those get pitched out the door once you start looking at the extant words that are written and really seriously chewing on those words and seeing where it is he's coming from. And, you know, the light thing, the Schroeder's breakdown on the light, that was the thing that made me realize this is all real. And then further, and yada yada, when you get into Che and you understand how, you know, time rolls out, mm-hmm. everything he says he made in any epoch of time, that's what appears in the fossil record.
Yeah, mm-hmm. that's pretty scary.
You know, yeah, that's then you know, okay, this is all very real. You know, but you're looking at it in a realistic realm now as opposed to a religious tradition.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to throw that in there because it's one of those things that's kind of important. But when, you know, at that point, I'm assuming, JB, you began, like me, to realize I'm looking at something real. Isn't that what happened?
Yeah. Well, a lot of it was also just, you know, I would look at what Craig's translation was, and then I look at every other Bible, and I'm like, all right, these are too divergent. Either he's making this up, or these translations really are as horrible as he's claiming. And, you know, I didn't know him from Adam, so I'm like, I don't want to take his word for it. I need to find a way to verify this. And that's, I went out and bought Logos and broke it down, and it took me, probably about a week or two just figure out how to use that, and then, you know, started, you know, just picking the verses that were the most contradictory, the verses he had that were the most different than what was in a standard Bible translation. And I would start looking up word by word. Okay, well, yeah, he's got this, he's got this. How did they get that? I have no clue, but his makes perfect sense. And just started checking his translations like that, to the point where it was like, okay, there's this, everything that's in here has been totally misrepresenting what is actually written. He's not perfect, but he's representing it as accurately as I'm capable of doing myself. So, and yeah, it's just kind of, it, like you said, it just really clicks. Everything starts to make sense at that point. When you realize, you know, like I said, the three destinations, the micromanaging God goes right out the window if you study Scripture. Mm-hmm. Every drawback, everything that was holding me back from believing in God, you know, to the point where now it's not even believing, it's knowing God, you know, just kind of fell out the way once, you know, I started examining the words for myself and looking at Scripture, and it became, you know, all those things that were holding me back just were religious. And that was probably the hardest thing for me to do. And I think one of the hardest things most people have is separating God from religion. Because society, mm-hmm. you know, everything, religions around us, society, everything we grow up in equates religion and God. You know, you mention anything about God, people assume you're religious.
Right.
And, you know, right. And separating that and realizing, you know, God has nothing to do with religion. Any of them, no interest in them, no desire for them. He hates them. That just was like, okay, now this is, you know, once you get that separation in your mind and you get to that personal God, that personal relationship, and you start viewing everything from that perspective, it just clicks.
Well, yeah, and Hani, she just messaged me and mentions that, you know, choices are also shown throughout the Torah. I mean, good choices and bad choices and the consequences of whatever choice. And, of course, anytime somebody listened to Yahweh's instructions, you know, there was a positive outcome. When they decided not to listen to him, there was a negative outcome. Yeah. And it's
well, you know,
Torah
like,
means instructions. I mean, yeah, I think listening to the Torah is going to be the best bet. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say, it's like if you look at the story of Lot leaving Sodom and Gomorrah. Yahweh didn't tell him, you know, if you turn back, if you look back, I will turn you to stone. What he told him was, if you look back, you will turn to stone. You know, he told them not to look back. He didn't cause what happened to happen. Their not listening caused what happened to happen. It was the natural consequence of their choice.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's what God does. He doesn't do a lot of punishment. You know, that's why there, you know, so few people, relatively speaking, will be in hell. You know, majority of them will suffer the natural consequence of not choosing to be part of his family. You know, going back to the soul being mortal. Mortal means
Dennis,
it lives,
Dennis Treacy,
it dies.
Ed wrote on a post, you know, I got a small note that I put out a number of times, but if anybody, you know, that hasn't seen it begins to look at it, they see where they've been had and what's in the witness writings. And in Matanyah, it starts out, not anyone, which is pos, calling me Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven. We all know that. And then he describes Christians, and he says, get away from me because you're Torahless, you know. Dennis wrote, and this is your typical, you know, why, you know, you were saying you look at that Yada's translations and looked at their translations. He's, you know, anyone is pos. That means a whole. It means everybody, anyone. Mm-hmm. That's the Greek word pos that is in that oldest papyrus verse we have of Matanyah there. And it's defined in Strong's as meaning all, every, the whole, and entire. But a fellow on YouTube, pointed this out to me. However, if the verse is talking about all, every, or whole, suggested the verse means all, everyone, or a whole group who called him Lord, Lord is not going to enter the kingdom. He said he was going to have to do some research and get back to me. Okay.
So. Go for it.
Pause. Go do your research.
Yeah.
This is how wild it gets. That's really how wild it gets. Do you see there's no loophole there?
No, it's half of these things that I look up. It gives you no wiggle room. This is what it means. This is what it means. And the further back you go, the more clear it seems to be.
I'd say if I said everyone, the entire group that does this, the whole of everyone that says this,
pretty clear.
And then you go, wow, this just went up against my religious traditions. I'm going to go have to study a way I can sidestep this issue. I guess that's what they're saying.
I've had people that run back to their preacher and say, because they don't know what to do with things like that, so they run back to the preacher, and the preacher calms them down and tells them, oh, that's not really true, and what this means is. And it's just, we all seem to, when you have that frame of mind, and I once did, you go back and you try to find somebody that'll tell me what this really means that is comforting, so I can keep my religion. That's all I can figure. Because some things I told someone one time were so clear, and he got it right away. He started reading yada yada. He was on the same page with me on so many things, and then all of a sudden it disturbed him so much. I asked him, have you mentioned this to your wife and your kids? He said, no, I'm still doing my homework. And I said, well, fair enough. And he said, and he was fine. And then he came in one day, and he didn't want to talk about it anymore. And I said, what's the matter? And he said, well, I took all my ideas, and I went to the preacher, my local preacher, and I talked to him, and he said, this can't be right. Okay. So, no debate, that was it for him.
It's part of the whole indoctrination of religion is this idea that you are not smart enough to think about this on your own. You're not smart enough to research this on your own. You're not smart enough to come to an understanding on your own. You need our help.
Yeah, you need the rabbi, you need the priest.
That's the majority of my family is they all think they're too dumb to study any of it by themselves. And like, it doesn't take a whole lot of intelligence. It just takes effort.
Yeah. When you, what I was going to ask you, JB, when you started to share this with people, what are some of the things that you encountered?
Well, first person I really started sharing it with was Patty, and with the time we were dating, so it was kind of fun because we kind of got to go through a lot of this together. And she came from a much more religious home than I did. Her family is very religious, and she was more open to it than almost anyone I've ever met. That's probably why she's really come to know y'all through this, is, she was open to it. She was, fortunately, as religious as her family was, her father was actually this based on what I know. I never actually got to meet him. He unfortunately passed away before I started dating her. But he was seems to me to have been a very smart guy and really helped to teach her, at least, to think for herself and to question, not to accept anything. But most of my conversations tended to be with her other family members. And her one sister is extremely religious, and we had some knock-down, drag-out arguments over stuff, and she just wanted nothing to do with anything other than what her pastor had taught her. But then on the other hand, her other sister and her brother-in-law, who that's actually how I met her, was through her brother-in-law, is my best friend. They were much more open, at least to discussing it at times. They would, we'd talk about it a lot, and then we wouldn't talk about it for a while, and they kind of thought it over, mulled it over, and then it would come up again. And me and him used to have conversations before I ever started reading anything in Yada Yada or anything like that, where he was Christian and I was taking up the atheist position or agnostic position. So that had been part of our conversations all that long. And him and his wife have actually really come a long way and are started, they keep the feast with us and they've started doing a lot of studying on their own.
That goes to show that they did some studying. See, what I can't figure out is this, okay? What kind of? Of course, I'm used to it now. I don't even try to figure it out, if truth be told. But it was a bewilderment to me when I first started sharing Yahweh's words in extant form, where people could actually see them. You know, if Yahweh says, as an example, you know, you people who remove my name from my words, you're going to be incarcerated. And those people that follow them are going to be dead. You know, I mean, if it was no big deal, why bother to mention that? You know, I mean, they're going to be punished. And when you show that to somebody, and of course in their Bible, they've done it. You know, it no longer says Yahweh, it says Lord. So they did exactly, it's a prophecy too, you know.
They did exactly what he said they would do.
Yeah, he did exactly, and of course, doing exactly what he said they would do in opposition to his words and for such low regard of his name, what these people have decided to do is just block out any reality, because if you show something like that, out of extant material, the word-for-word breakdown, and I realize there can't be a perfect interpolation, but it can come awfully close. You know, certainly the idea gets across. And you show that to them, and they begin digging their heels in and defending religious material. That is the exact last thing I would expect from anybody who was honestly searching for the truth.
Mm-hmm.
I was happy to know Yahweh wasn't a religious deity. He didn't lord over me. He isn't everywhere. He doesn't know my every little thought. I mean, weren't you happy to know that? I mean, why would you be unhappy about that? Was that
nothing I found has been,
it's very
has bothered
free.
Me. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just saying, it's very freeing not having this idea of a God who's just up there waiting for you to make a mistake so he can kick you out.
You know, in Christian terms, you always are praying to please forgive me almost daily, hourly, lunchtime.
Yeah.
You know, in your prayers, it's like, well, does he or doesn't he? I mean, what's the criteria that you have to ask him constantly? Or if you sit down with people and they want to pray over their food, they're asking God to forgive them again. I'm going, gosh, that seems awful tiresome. You know, so I don't know. When you first started sharing, how did that affect your family?
Well, my wife, of course, was never a Christian. She was more of a secular humanist type, yoga type person from Iran. So I had no issues there. My children were grown; they were all out of the house. So there was really no issue with me with family at all.
Okay, so they
still, you know, like I say, being raised by atheists, my dad's dead now, and he's dead, you know. But my mom and all my siblings, they're all pretty much atheists, pretty much.
Hmm.
And I don't really talk to them. So it had no effect on me that way.
Yeah.
You know, where it affects me mostly is just socially, you know, because if I'm in a room and somebody brings up religion, I start ripping it apart. I don't care what religion it is. It doesn't matter to me.
Yeah.
and so, you know, I'm probably not real popular along those lines.
Yeah.
And I don't expect to be. Don't want to
no.
be. Don't care
no.
to be.
No, it's just tough. All of a sudden, you learn these things, and you desperately want to share them because it's so fascinating, and you hit just a wall with so many people. It's to me, it was a little bit, when I first figured out what Yahweh's name is, and I had heard that as a Christian, but we were told it didn't mean anything, you know, to use it. You know, you could use. He was happy with any name you called him, that sort of thing. So when it finally was clear that that was his name, and I would run around and tell even all my students, you know, we would talk about things, and they would say God or something, and I would say, you know what God's name is, and we'd go through the whole thing a little bit, Boy, talk about turn everybody off. They just like look at you like you're a pariah.
The world's eyes glaze over.
I know.
And you know, really think about the position. You guys, think about this position. All this popped out of nothingness by a total accident, mm-hmm. which has got to be insane.
Yeah.
I mean, that's insane on its face.
Sure.
Or, just as Yahweh said, you know, he made it in 6 days from his perspective at the point of inception. He created all these things on these given days, you know, like day three, day five, day six,
mm-hmm.
day one, you know.
Sure.
You know, he created all these things, and it actually plays out, if you understand the way time rolls out. Everything happens in those epoch of times.
Verbatim.
Exactly what he said. Now, so we can either believe that, and with somebody who backed it up, I mean, we can look at the Burkle crater.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating.
It happened to manage to hit during Noah's lifetime, and it would just happen to throw mm-hmm. enough moisture in the air that it would cause it to rain for something like 40 days and nights.
Mm-hmm.
And it would just happen to cause this deluge in that part of the world.
All of those things are totally measurable. I mean, it's scientific. You can look at
they're
them.
They're verifiable.
Yeah, exactly.
And if you've ever studied statistics, you start adding it up, it becomes, you know, the astronomical unlikeliness of a universe coming into existence times the astronomical unlikeliness of that universe being capable of supporting matter times the astronomical unlikeliness of that universe creating life. Or creating planets capable of creating life.
Yeah, you're into
astronomical improbabilities of life existing.
Yeah.
Of the rate of expansion of life. It's just astronomical times astronomical times astronomical to the point where it's what scientists would call rationally impossible.
Or
right.
Creating
so you're no longer.
You're
no longer
people
rational.
Who could actually debate this thing. That's
right, you're no longer rational if you advance those ideas. I mean, it's an insane proposition. And so, therefore, if there was a God, did he put this stuff all in writing somewhere?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it turns out, yeah, he did. And the way he backs it all up is that anything that he calls scripture, anything he calls his words, has prophecy in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, that was the key for me was once I came to realize that, yeah, there is a God. There is no denying that there is a creator God. You know, for me, the thing was at that point, if this God had something to tell us, what on earth could possibly be more important than coming to figure out what he had to tell us? And, you know, you realize that there is a God. There could be nothing more important than that. You know, the guy who created the universe, you know, the being that created this everything, created us, had something to tell us. Don't you want to know? How could you not want to know?
Well, I would think that.
Well, exactly.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that got me. You know, Kirk, you were saying that your students, their eyes glaze over.
Oh, they do?
His name's Yahweh. He really did this in 6 days. Let me show you how that works. Blah, 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 and you just see everybody falling asleep, and you're like, what the hell's wrong with this?
It was like talking to almost anyone in my family.
Yeah, well, I had people, you know, once I went, and I did this before I ever read Yada Yada. I had already read about Easter and Christmas and all, and I would mention this, that, you know what Christmas is really, where it really came from, or you know where Easter really came from, such and such, and boy, that was just like, please don't ruin my holiday again. By telling me these things, so they just don't want to know.
Yeah, you either get the people
funny
who don't
enough,
want to
these
know,
are the same.
Or you get the people who want to argue the religious side.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's right. But I mean, those people are hope because supposedly they care what God said, right? I mean, that's their position.
Yeah,
and they're in of course, or what their religious tradition teaches. I mean, and you lay out, you know, the truth to them, and you can see that the truth opposes their religious beliefs, and what happens? You know, they hate you. That's all.
Yeah.
Now, I've had so many diverse students and friends, and some of them are, Hindu, and some of them are, I've had Muslim students, and I've had, you know, you name it. I've crossed the board and have talked to, and I've never been ugly to them or not listened to them or, you know, when they talk about what they, I'm probably a little more knowledgeable about some of the things they believe than they are. But, I mean, I didn't turn them off and just treat them like a pariah because they wanted to tell me about their Catholic Church or their Greek Orthodox Church or what have you. You know, I'm open to discussion. But I was really stunned at how quickly people just turned off. It kind of really set me back for a while. I'm going, what's wrong here? I was just so disappointed. Don't you want to know this? You act like you do. So
I think typically what people want is a sterile conversation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just a sterile conversation.
Yeah. No one wants to talk about anything serious or real.
Yeah.
Unless you're talking about an agreement.
Mm-hmm.
If you're confirming what they believe, they love that.
Yeah.
As soon as
you
start contradicting it, then they're out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can't step on their sacred cows or it's over.
Mm-hmm.
No. So when you, what was it, you know, was the trigger for you, JB? Was it just, was it the science part of it and the script, I mean, and the prophecy?
That was really kind of the start, yeah. That was just kind of what made it, you know, click that, okay, I need to look into this more. Because I was really just kind of your typical, you know, 20-something, you know, concerned about my life and what's going on, and that was it. I really wasn't concentrating on anything bigger. You know, it was one of those, like I said, I was an agnostic in terms of, you know, there may be a God, and in fact, there probably is a God, but you know, he's not found in these religions, and I don't know if there's any way to know him, and really right now I can't be bothered. I was in that. So when something came along that kind of clicked on me, like, you know, no, there is a reason to, you know, take this serious. You know, there is a God. He did communicate with us, obviously. You know, the creation account shows that, you know, what's in this Bavarshi's book was inspired by a being that existed at that point. And, you know, he's claiming to be the one who did it, and I have no reason to doubt that. So it's like, okay, I need to take this serious now.
Mm-hmm.
And get that, you know, there is a God. What else can be more important than coming to know him? And so I just kind of delved in with that mentality. And, you know, I keep a copy of my desktop background as, you know, just a constant reminder for me. I have Hosea 4:6, my people are destroyed and perish as a result of lack of knowledge.
Yeah, that's kind of a constant reminder.
Because you hear people that are like,
Torah,
you know,
so
well, God's not going to kick me out because I don't know enough. Well,
yeah.
Yeah, he will.
Yeah. So when you finally put it all together and you got to the point about the covenant relationship and how did that affect you right away? I mean, in the Moed Mikraes and all that, was it anything negative about that when you read that?
Oh no, it was the only one I would say was actually negative was when I first started trying to celebrate the festivals. Mm-hmm. The first year we celebrated Passover, we ended up doing it. Patty's parents had done Passover several times as a kid, but they did it in a very Christian way. They had this. Her mom had this book that took like the Jewish Passover Seder and just gave everything a Christian twist.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first year we tried doing that, she volunteered to do it at her house. We're like, okay, well that'll work because we were living in a small apartment. So we did that, and it ended up being this scripted Seder, and that was really just miserable for me.
Yeah.
And we've never done that again.
Yeah.
So that would be the only thing that would, but that wasn't because of Passover. That was because of how we chose to try and do it that year. Yeah. Since then, we do it at our house. We have people over. We just have a good time and discuss Yah's word, and it's been great every year since then. But all of the Mikra are just, you know, they're fun, they're relaxing. You know, I tell people, you know, if you're worried about it and you're, you know, worried about doing something wrong, then you're doing it wrong.
Mm-hmm. That's fair. So how about you, Larry?
Never felt like
I'm sorry.
I was going to say, just not once has it ever felt like a bother.
There's really nothing. There's nothing about it, you know. That if you look through all the things, it's a little bit hard to walk away completely and realize what it is to walk away. I mean, it's hard if you. For me, it wasn't very hard to walk away from religion. It was, but it's kind of difficult to walk away from people when they just absolutely don't want any part of it. You know, you lose a certain. Family and a certain group of friends and so forth, and then when you introduce it to them, and then they kind of act like they're interested, and then they after a while they turn off. It's almost kind of lonesome on there for a while until you learn to deal with it, you know, and just realize that a lot of people is, you know, only thousands will turn to y'all anyway. I mean,
yes, and that's
right,
and that's one of the things that I did realize. I realized at that point, I said, well, you're going to have to be like Dode, you know, or Noah, or Lot. I mean, you are really going to have to be a one in a million. That was my first thought. Mm-hmm. You know, since then I've heard Yada say it 1,000 times, but that is correct thinking. And then in this study we've been doing of the 119th, the way it was actually written as opposed to, you know, the nonsense you find in the religious books. You know, here we have Dode crediting every bit of his success with the knowledge of the Torah. You know, he didn't credit, you know, standing in front of the Philistines and slaying, you know, some guy 6'9". You know, I mean, he didn't say any of those things counted.
No.
You know. I mean,
none of those
things
are even
counts.
In his writings.
No, he doesn't.
None
he's not
of
a bragger.
His writings mention anything about that.
No.
Right. He isn't, say, Bill Clinton or somebody like that. I mean, he's you know, I mean, Dode was out there saying, you know, and I credit the fact I'm going to have, you know, eternal life in a perfect situation with your Torah. I credit your Torah. I love your Torah for that reason.
Yeah.
And so then you begin to understand, hey, knucklehead, it's not you doing anything, you know. But, I mean, isn't that what we're taught in religion? Religion, they say, okay, you just have faith, you're not really doing anything. But aren't they busily wanting to be forgiven and seen as a guy, which this is a self-delusional thing in the world, with a pure heart?
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine a person with a pure heart? I've never met one.
No.
You know, I mean, it just... But that's the delusion. I mean,
well,
it's got to be.
The same thing with Paul's
letter. Well, they want you to become perfect.
You know, Paul speaks of salvation through faith, but then goes on to give a bunch of rules that you need to follow.
Mm-hmm.
And Christianity does the same thing. They speak of, you know, salvation as a gift. It's free. You just have to have faith. But then they all have these rules that they judge you by anyways. And so if you're in, you go to that church and you, you know, if it's a Baptist church and you drink alcohol, ooh, you're going to hell for that one. Never mind, you know, they say it's, you know, free gift, but they have their own rules. They just don't like to admit to it.
Well, Catholics do the same thing. My wife would tell you that in her particular case, you could do communion, if you got divorced, then you couldn't do communion. So then, you know, so you're out there, you know. It's all rules on whatever they do.
But you were, I mean... There we are. We're right to where everything counts, and we're, what is that? That's the Torah. That's Yahweh's instructions, and that does not mean law. That's why Abraham observed the Torah. He took Yahweh's instructions.
Absolutely.
You know,
he walked
away
as quick as he could. You know, raised his family.
Yeah, he walked out of the most religious place in the world at that time.
Absolutely.
You know, that's something religious people need to, you know, keep in mind, is that Babylon was the most religious place on the planet. Did Yahweh say, go immerse yourself in religion? You know,
well,
coexist. You know, he didn't say any of that.
Right.
So
take it right to the Christians, though, I mean, and ask yourself, did Yahusha, did he embrace any religious organization? Did he embrace any religious people? Or did he couldn't stand them? Cut them to the quick. Everywhere he went,
right?
Did he choose anyone to follow him? There was a religious person, not one.
Yeah, just show me in Yahweh's words. you know, where he says go be religious anywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, he trashes the clerics.
Uh-huh.
You said, you know, he doesn't really talk anything about Easter and Christmas and so forth. Yeah, he does. I mean, he does.
Oh, yeah. In
very negative terms.
Yeah, he talks about it all, just not in any kind of good way.
No.
Yeah, it's bad news, you know. I mean, it's all bad news, and they all need to be, you know. He talks about all their symbols being broken and destroyed and burnt mm-hmm. to the ground, and that's when he's happy. So mm-hmm. You know, that's hardly a ringing endorsement of religion, but that brings us to the terms and conditions
right.
of the covenant, which is what Dode has really been going over here that we've been, you know, studying for the last few months. So with that, Kirk, you want to go over
sure.
the terms and conditions? You know,
well,
there
sure.
are five
I'll,
of them.
I'll give you kind of a quick synopsis of them. You know, and the first one, of course, and then y'all can talk about each one of them, or we can all just chat about them. But the first one, of course, that we just started with was we must leave Babylon, and Babylon, of course, is synonymous with confusion and that sort of thing, which is symbolic of mankind's beguiling, oppressive religious, political, economic, and militaristic schemes and societal customs and family traditions. So what is left to embrace that God has approved of? He's pretty much, you know, we've trashed religion, and rightfully so. But people have to remember, too, that it's just as much political as the same thing. They're one and the same animal, because I studied a lot of history, especially ancient history. And you cannot have a religion without a political agenda. The king, or the pharaoh, whatever, they have to have the religious thing to tell the people that God has appointed him, you know, to be your master. And you can't seem to have him, and then he needs them in order to do that for him, and then you need a military to enforce it. I mean,
yeah, go out there and die for king and country.
Absolutely.
Yeah, right.
It's the old English, you know, things to live by in England. Yeah. So tell me, if you would, guys, what in economics, tell me some scheme that's in there that was in Babylon that is not worthy of us walking away from. I mean, there's nothing there to embrace that I can see.
No.
I mean, people manipulating other people isn't a grand idea after all.
No, no. Correct me if I'm wrong, but every one of those things are totally set up to contradict the Ten Statements in stone. You know, they all rob you. They all steal from you. They all covet what you have. If you have anything, you know, if you're fortunate enough to have a little something, they steal your children to go off to military. I mean, you can make a list on everything they want from you. And they offer you nothing. Truly. I mean, who
offer you
where you from?
They offer you service to them. That's what they
service
offer
to
you.
Yeah, I may bow to them, yes. I may serve them.
Yeah, and then, you know, and we get into the next, you know, of the five conditions out there. And it's pretty important because, you know, the religious copy edit is always faith, 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 faith.
Mm-hmm.
And Yahweh's on this other side, he's going, look, religious mumbo jumbo is exactly that.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to prove to you, you can trust and rely on me. And I just want you to trust me. I mean, that's
right.
What he's saying.
Right.
And so, you know, there's so many people, you know, when you had a religious mindset, and I want you to think about this, really, when you were in church and they talked about Abraham, they talked about he had so much faith, he went up there on that mountain, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it
that's
isn't
right.
that he had, yeah, and of course that's how you picture it. You can't picture it any other way because you're not thinking about it with an open mind. He knew Yahweh. He had walked with him, talked with him.
Yeah, there was no faith.
He'd been certainly blessed by him. Yeah, he didn't have faith in the unknown. He came to trust and rely on Yahweh's instructions. And that's Torah. That's what
well,
it means.
Well, didn't he tell the people down at the bottom of the mountain that he was going to come back? He was going to return with his son?
Yes.
Before he took him up there? Didn't he know that there would be something provided? There would be, so that's not faith. That's He knew.
He knew, exactly.
So we trust and rely as opposed to have faith. Go ahead.
You got to trust him. He must have walked away from your life and everything he had in his life and crossed the desert. He didn't know where he was going. So he obviously had a tremendous amount of trust in God's word to take that step forward. That's not faith and a hope. I mean, he must have really believed it in his being, and so in every step he took, he just got stronger and stronger because everything he told him, he kept happening.
Well, he didn't have faith in God. He knew Yahweh. There's a big difference in the two, you know.
One of my favorite stories of Abraham was when Yahweh was going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah, and he told Abram what his plan was. And, Abram had that. I love it because it just displays that knowing of a person and that comfort level of the relationship. You know, Yahweh came to him and said, I'm going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. And, Abram, said, thought of, I know you. I've come to know you. We've had this relationship. I know you. And, if there's, righteous people in that city, you're not going to kill them along with all the others just because they happen to be there. Everything I know about you tells me this is not you. And so he questioned, Yahweh based on what he knew of him. Basically what he was saying was, everything I know about you says you won't do this. And, in the end he was right. Yahweh was like, all right, they went through the whole thing of, can you find 50 people? Well, no, you can't. Can you find 25? No, you can't. Well, you did find one. You found Lot. And yes, I will spare Sodom and Gomorrah until Lot is removed. Abraham knew that from the beginning, that, if there was even one person there, he thought there was more, he really thought there were more good people there. He was a bit of a pessimist like some of us are and really thought there were more good people there than one. But in the end, Yahweh wasn't going to kill someone who was righteous, just because of where they were. But, I love it because it's that level of knowing someone, that level of comfort in a relationship. One of the things that reminds me of is I was talking earlier about my brother-in-law, and we've always been good. I've been good friends with him for years, and one of the things after I'd known him a year or two, we were talking at the time. I was very political. I never really was religious, but my religion fell into the politics at one point. And we were talking, and I made a comment about the Libertarian Party, and he made the comment, if it's liberal, then I'm for it. And I'm like, wait a minute, stop. Everything I know about you, and we've got to know each other pretty good, tells me you were not a liberal. But he was raised in a Democratic home and, thought he was a liberal Democrat. And we started talking policies. I'm like, well, what about this? What about this? And showed him that you're not liberal. You're a conservative. You just don't know it. But it was, that same thing. Yahweh, or Abram knew Yahweh to that level, that what he said was not making sense to him. I know you so well that I know this is not right. And he conversed with him on a friendship level, on that comfort level, and came to understand what Yahweh was trying to say. I love that because that is the relationship that Yah wants, and that's the relationship I want with him.
And, that's almost interesting, too, the way it went down. Lot, he was listening to Yahweh's Torah.
Well, didn't he walk around with Abraham all that time? He must have had the feast with Abraham. He must have done all of the things, and he had to be part of the family.
That was exactly the deal. That's what made him upright,
Exactly.
Yahweh says that. People like to go, well, what about Abraham? He didn't have the Torah. Well, he didn't have a book called the Torah, but, read in Bereshit, and I believe it's when he's talking to Jacob. He talks about, Abram was righteous because he observed my Torah. He uses the word Torah. Well before the, five books written by, described by Moshe were scribed, he says Abraham observed his Torah. He did. He observed his instructions. His teaching is guided.
I can't believe that Yahweh walked with Adam and Chawa in the evening all those years, and it had to be years, all those years, and didn't discuss all this stuff to the degree that they knew what the Torah was.
No.
I mean, they may not know what you know now because you have everything that's come afterwards. But they knew more than enough to be able to walk with Yah. All the patriarchs, or whatever you want to call them, and from Abraham and his son Yishak and Jacob, and all the way through the 12 sons of Jacob. I mean, they knew. They had heard these stories. That was part of the memorializing of the Torah to begin with. They passed it on. The head guy would pass on to the family and keep doing it. So, and I'm sure the two sons of Adam knew enough that they would have been able to observe enough Torah to be part of the family, certainly. I mean,
yeah.
it would make any sense to me.
Well, you say enough of the Torah. What, if you're following the instructions, if you're
mm-hmm.
actually observing the instructions, I mean, we all know that there's a whole lot of things in what is called the Torah today, which is really
mm-hmm.
a history, that we cannot do. Nobody can do them.
No.
Not the most Orthodox Jew can do them, because there's no temple. There's no Lowy. I mean, there's a big problem here. There's no storehouse. So what is it that he said we had to do for all time? Well, that brings us, you know, I mean, we walked out of Babylon. We,
mm-hmm.
we learned to trust and rely on Yahweh.
Right.
Well, you know, he brought up these seven parties, these seven
mm-hmm.
get-togethers, these seven celebrations, these
yeah.
seven chag that are for all people, for all time, for all
yeah.
generations, just like his name is.
Yeah.
You know, and boom, you know, there it is, the walk.
Yeah,
you know,
walk
of the way, isn't it?
Yeah,
that's
pathway.
The path right there.
And what, is,
and
what does he say that when you do, what does he say when you do will happen? He says you become.
Well, that's the way, that's the way all the all disputes are settled.
Right, you become perfect, yeah.
Right.
Everything is solved there. He's demonstrating the beauty of that to me, you know, the Moed Mikraes, that makes it so interesting to me, is he solves every problem, and we're not doing something like when we celebrate it, we're just celebrating the fact that he did it all, and we do it in these different parties, these different festivals. To just emphasize even more the different parts of it. I mean, it's just, God, it's a beautiful story.
Yeah, and in each of these, what is he saying? He's saying,
mm-hmm.
and do not do the work, you know, of the heavenly messenger. You know,
mm-hmm.
don't do the work of Yahusha. You can't do the work. You know, if I'm not doing the work of God, and I'm not.
You can't.
He did the work. I'm
yeah.
just observing it.
Yeah.
But I'm also giving credit.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I'm giving credit where credit is due as
Absolutely.
Well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, had he not done this, had he not drawn attention in this way, and that's one of the reasons I think it was such a horrible fulfillment process. And I mean, there's no other way to describe those
mm-hmm.
first 2 days. But just
yeah.
horrible. You know, it was... to show, look, I've got nothing to gain here. You know, it's to draw attention. I mean, how could your attention not be drawn to that?
No.
You know, now that's not where it should end either. But
no.
You know, I mean, you know, he blazed the path with, you know, by taking some severe strokes that were
mm-hmm.
due the family, according to him, and I'm sure that's true.
Yeah.
So,
when you consider walking the walk, I mean, this is wow.
Yeah, thou shalt lead from the front.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just the opposite of your military commanders.
Mm-hmm.
You know, thou shalt lead from behind. You know, or political leaders—they're not leaders. They're
thou shalt lead from a building
500,000
miles away.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right. So, you know, and those. Seven Moed Mikra are Pesach, Matzah, Bikurim, Shabuah, Teruah, Kippurim, and Sukkah.
Mm-hmm.
And they are all played out in human history. And there's a dress rehearsal for all of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've got the dress rehearsal, then you have the actual fulfillment process that occurs that he literally plays out in human history. And then what are we doing after that? Well, we're reading the covenant. We're coming to know and understand his terms, his conditions,
mm-hmm.
how to respond appropriately to them. You know, it wouldn't be appropriate for me to run into a church every Sunday, would it?
Hardly.
You know?
No.
I'd be embracing the enemy.
Yeah.
And you know, like they are, really.
Mm-hmm.
And you can, obviously, we can show them where Sunday worship comes from.
Mm-hmm. Here's a good clue, son.
that might be. Sol Invictus Mithras, you know. I mean, yeah, it's right out there, the day of the unconquerable sun. And what is Satan's name? Well, it's Halal Ben Shakar.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean?
Shine.
The arrogant, son of the rising morning sun. And that's mm-hmm. where he hides in religion. Halos and holy and Biblia, the sun goddess, and you know, all these things, you know, that are associated with religious worship and the sun. And nothing could be out front more than Ashura or Ishtar, which is now Easter. That's flat-out sun worship, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it would not be appropriate for me to say, yeah, I've come to know Yahweh, and I know he's not religious, and when I meet to have a celebration, it's not going to be a religious celebration. It's going to be a celebration because, I'll tell you what I celebrate more what I understand.
Mm-hmm.
It's a celebration because I have understanding, and I know it's understanding that leads to life. You know, it certainly isn't ignorance, right?
No, hardly. No, this is So now we've come to what you got four now, and now the fifth condition is, of course, circumcision. You know, for the male, all the males and the son, and the sons of the children. So, and there's really no negative thing about that. You know, Shudder and Miss show he's Yada's been covering that for about 3 weeks. You know, in Genesis 17:10 all the way through about the 15th or 7th. So it's and we have. I got to participate in some of it, and it's, you can't find anywhere where this is a negative thing. It's a superfluous piece of skin. He's very pointed in the sense of telling us where, getting his message across in a very sensitive little area. But certainly there's nothing about it other than it's a mark. It separates you. It separates you from most people.
There's no benefit to having it, and there are tons of benefits to removing it.
Absolutely, but
yeah. One is cervical cancer to women, as an example. That's one.
Really?
You know? Oh yeah, yes. Yeah. If a guy's circumcised, his wife is way less likely to get cervical cancer. You know?
Well, yeah. That's another one. Yeah.
And he starts right out there in Bereshit. I mean, he's clear about this all the way through it. It's reiterated a number of times. There's an apostrophe put on it over and over. I do think that part of the purpose of all that was to expose Paul. I really believe that.
I was going to say, that's what it did for me, because I just happened to be translating in Genesis that verse when Craig sent me the chapter for in questioning Paul, when he was writing the first rite of questioning Paul. I was one of the few that volunteered to help him edit it. But he sent me the chapter that he's addressing where Paul talks about circumcision, and it just so happened to be the exact week that I was translating this verse in Genesis about circumcision, and that was really the clincher for me on Paul. Up until then, I'd been playing, you know, I'd say now devil's advocate, but at the time I was real on the fence, and I was trying to present every challenge, like, well, you know, Paul could be meaning this, and well, if you look at it this way, it's not entirely. I was playing that. I was really trying to cling on to that. But then I read that. I read what Paul had to say, and I'm like, there is no. Yeah, it's over. He's out. There's no.
Yeah, you know, when Paul gets to the part where he says, I wish everybody that were getting circumcised under the Torah would be castrated, that kind of did it for me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he wrote
one
that
of those,
in P42, you know.
Yeah,
it was a clincher for me. It was, you know, at that point, there's, you know, I was before that, I was twisting what Paul wrote to try and make it fit Torah. And at that point, I had, you know, two options. Either twist what Yahweh wrote to fit Paul, or dismiss Paul. Because there was no twisting what, you know, Paul wrote. And really, you cannot twist what Yahweh wrote. So there's
oddly enough, James, oddly enough, it's the... that is the tack that most people take, the opposite tack from the one you did.
Yeah. I've talked to many people about that who will twist what Torah is saying. Yeah, the most common one is, you know, oh, well, that's only speaking of Israel and ownership of the land. I don't live in the land, and I don't own the land, so I don't have to be circumcised. And I'm like, how can you look at what he's saying here and come to that conclusion? Now, if you want to say
he says they're stubborn.
That's okay.
I mean, the word he uses is arel, right? Stubborn, unresponsive, untrusting, unreliant, not listening, unobserving.
Well, that was like, I did a whole research, looked up every single use of the word mul, which is the word for circumcision in Hebrew. I looked up every use of that. But then last year, Craig asked me to do a show on circumcision again. I'm like, okay. And while I was looking at something, I realized that I missed something. There's another word that does, other than mul, there's two ways to say not circumcised. You could say lo mul, which literally not circumcised. But there's another word, it's on the tip of my tongue, but I can't think of what the word is exactly right off the top of my head. But it means uncircumcised. And I hadn't looked at every use of that. I started looking at every use of that. And when it's not speaking of the physical act of circumcision, it is used in the most negative and derogatory ways I've seen almost any Hebrew word used. Yeah, you know, it speaks of hell as the place of the uncircumcised. Yeah, you know, it is used, you know, when Moshe talks about not wanting to speak for God because he can't speak good, he says, I am of uncircumcised lip. You know, at every point where it is used, it is in the most negative connotations. Gives you an idea of what God's view on non-circumcision is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know, one of the things I want to point out here real quick, you know, if we go to the Bless Yahweh site, Richard's site, you can go up there and it says Table of Contents, and you'll see one that just says the five terms and conditions. And right under it, it has the five benefits, you know. That also tells us why he fulfilled the first four spring moed, you know, because everything that was needed to enter, to be in Yahweh's presence, you know, through the covenant, was fulfilled. It's all fulfilled. That's why, you know, I mean, teruah is important, but teruah is one of those back end things while mankind is falling and towards very close to the end. Then you got the fulfillment of teruah, kippurim, and sukkah, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Why don't we cover those five benefits? Like, obviously, the first one is. You know, eternal life. Passover gives you eternal life. I mean,
And can anybody uncircumcised enter into Passover?
Not one.
No one.
Go.
Anyone who attempts to celebrate, profit from, or be nourished by Passover, if he is not circumcised, he shall not succeed in his goal. The actual wording. I love that wording.
And JB, I know you know why, but why is that deadly?
Oh, well, it's one of the things I love is because one of the challenges you get to circumcision is people will be like, well, you point out, well, you can't celebrate Passover unless you're, well, you can celebrate the other festivals. Yeah, but if you don't celebrate Passover, the other festivals are relevant.
They live eternally.
if you celebrate. You don't benefit from Passover, but you do benefit from matzah. That's not much of a benefit because your life is very, very short in the grand scheme of things. Yeah, same thing. You benefit from Shavuah. You know, empowerment doesn't mean a whole lot in the short term. Without benefiting from Passover, all the other benefits are really kind of meaningless almost in the grand scheme of things.
And nobody wants to live eternally separated.
Yeah, most
There's
definitely.
Nothing worse than that.
That is
well, one other thing I'd point out, I've yet to meet the first person that really understands that, you know, that what PSOC's about, eternal life. One who thinks that, okay, I don't need to be circumcised. All of them I know are aware they need to be circumcised. And by the way, you know, I can't imagine what benefit you could get out of Kippurim or Sukkah if you're not circumcised, because you're not going to have eternal life, right? I mean,
no.
Nobody that is circumcised or anybody that understands this is circumcised for that very reason, you know.
And then what good is it to be, if you don't celebrate the next 1 month, I mean, what good is it to be have eternal life?
That would be
eternally separated in the abyss. You would wish you were dead,
and you can't get out. I mean, it's not like you were up and out against him. You just this is unbelievably bad move not to be circumcised and do Passover.
And you know, if there was
not do Passover, but you know, celebrate Passover.
If there was a person next door that. You know, got deathly ill, and you knew them, and you knew they were deathly ill, you'd probably bring some soup over to them or, you know, try to comfort them or help them when you could, wouldn't you?
Somewhat. Yeah. Of course.
I mean, you know, that's kind of a bare minimum thing. We see somebody in need, we help them, don't we?
Absolutely.
Yeah, but is that in the five terms and conditions?
Not a one.
No.
That's in God's overall plan. You know, he planned. He's plenty of stuff about helping your neighbors and taking care.
Well, but
of
that's
people.
Reading the covenant.
But that's not what we're talking. Yeah, it's not exactly not what you're talking about right now. I mean, this is life and death, and that's not part of it. I mean, we just assume a character would a decent repute would do all that sort of thing anyway. But
there's people out there that seem to have a decent character about them that do those sorts of things.
Of course.
And yet they do not meet the five conditions of the covenant. Thus, they don't get the five benefits of the covenant.
There's a lot of them. Right. I've known some great people who have no clue about God.
Yeah.
They're great people. They do good things on earth. And when they die, that's going to be the end of them.
So that's not it.
Yeah, it's shocking, isn't it? I mean, people go out and they dedicate their entire lives, you know, to causes that really don't matter. In the end, they don't matter.
But they haven't shared anything that's eternal.
No. Well, that's one of the things Yahweh, when he describes Americans, you know, but he over in Yashayah, where he says woe to, you know, he says woe to this country that forces Israel to give up land with a giant navy. He says they run around talking, saying nothing at all.
Yeah,
it sounds like American politicians.
But
it sounds like American people in general. You know, I mean, we had this discussion earlier. You know, you're in a room, you bring up what's important, and everybody's eyes glaze over.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's the end of that.
But the beauty of sharing this is when if I was sharing this with you and you accepted the terms and conditions of the covenant, the promises that Yah makes, even in the fourth one by itself, but I mean the ones that we know throughout all his word, there's all those things that are so necessary for you would be taken care of anyway. So I don't need to take care of those things for you. You know, I don't have to set up a charitable trust to help everyone. I'm not saying that's a bad thing. That's fine. But I'm saying if you really embrace the covenant, all those things come with it. So I would think you would, plus eternal life and with him, plus. So, I mean, the cart before the horse.
Well, yeah, that's exactly right. But, I mean, if his words are true, let's say I go out and set up a foundation that's concerned with benefiting abused children. You know, that in and of itself, you know, that could be a pretty decent thing to do.
That's very kind of hard thing to do.
But if that's all I've ever done, and the, you know, other than that I have faith and I pray a lot, How did I meet those five terms and conditions? Walking out of Babylon, trusting in Yahweh, you know, walking through the seven invitations, you know, reading his covenant material and coming to understand his true nature and being circumcised. Well, I didn't meet any of that criterion, did I?
But if you had that kind of heart, you would think you would want to give him, show him the way to eternal life as well. I mean, what good?
Well,
is
you
it
or
there?
I might feel that way.
Yeah.
You and I might feel that way. But I'm saying that the average person out there that's doing, you know, whatever life's work and putting it in their curriculum vitae or what have you, the average person out there doesn't have any interest at all in Yahweh.
No.
None.
That's one of the biggest stumbling blocks I have found with religious people, too, is, you know, getting away from that mind, that human mindset of good. You know, it's the idea of, you know, someone you know, you care about, who's been done all these good things, yeah, that they're not going to be in heaven. You know, I didn't have it too much because, you know, for me, like I said, I came to, you know, I basically rejected God at a young age. And, yeah, but my grandparents are the two sweetest, nicest, most giving, loving, caring people I have ever known. And yeah, but they didn't know God, and I accept that, and I know that. But for someone who grew up with or recently lost someone who they care about, who was a good, caring, loving, decent person, and you know the idea of not seeing them again, that is like one of the biggest stumbling blocks people have, I think.
That's tough.
Idea that your loved one's not going to be in heaven with you.
Yeah,
but isn't that the way of Babylon? They tell you that if you go out and you're basically a kind person who is selfless and sacrifices himself for the benefits of others.
Well, that's what Rick Warren sells. That's his whole program.
Yeah.
Right. Then you've got a mega church.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Right.
And it's a mega
lie. You're still not meeting, you still don't know Yahweh. Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, yeah, meeting his conditions is really a part of it, but you know, if you meet his conditions, then you know him. And
with
that relationship, it's not so much doing those five things, but those five things introduce you to him.
Yeah, well, that's what's relational, because by doing these things, you begin to understand he's not lording over everyone, he's not omnipresent. He honestly cares about people who listen to him. He really cares a lot, a lot about those people. And these are the people that he's going to watch over. And then, doesn't he say that they all go their own way? Isn't that what he basically says about
Absolutely.
People? They all go their own way.
And then they'll
and
approach
when
him. I was going to say, and then
yeah,
they'll
and
approach
when
him at the end. I beg your pardon. Go ahead.
No, in the end, what if they got a handful of nothing?
Yeah.
You know, I went out and I set up an organization that dealt with treating injured animals.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I'm all for treating injured animals. I really am. I've done it.
Yeah.
But that in and of itself doesn't mean I have a relationship with Yahweh.
No.
And the only way we're going to get the relationship is exactly what JB said, looking at his material and considering what he said and the choices people made, good and bad, really looking at it. I mean, come on. Every one of us here had to believe that God was this fearsome religious deity. I believe that.
How could I not believe that? Yeah.
And nothing's further from the truth. Go ahead.
the only thing I was going to interject a minute ago is, you know, just a reminder that once again, at the end, they turn to Yahweh, and he says to them, he says, you know, that they say, well, look at all the wonderful works we've done. I don't care whether it was a mega church or a charity or whatever, they're going to plead, well, wait a minute, Lord, look at the wonderful things we've done.
I never knew
said,
you.
I never knew you'd get away from me. What a horrible thing to have him say.
Well, you know, and it's not like anything else. We fail a test, we can retake it. We lose a job, we can find another one. I mean, this is the ultimate. You know,
finality.
You can't talk your way out of this one. I don't care how smooth you are. It just isn't going to work. I mean, I'm sure they're the silver-tongued devils in there. Rick Warren, what do you mean? I did good things for people. Well, I extorted them.
Who cares
you know?
I ignored everything you said? I helped people. I made people feel good about themselves.
Yeah. And how much help in the end was that? It was none, because the very people he's describing, I only know of one religion that does all that, by the way, prophesizes in his name, does great works in his name, and calls him Lord, and speaks inspired utterances.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's something I never could understand, even as a Christian. I mean, I didn't go that whacked out. You know, I know some people have, but I mean, you know, when you look at these tongues.
Yeah.
Oh, man. I mean, I think of Barat, if you ever saw that movie. You know, I mean, it's just unbelievably stupid. And it's hard to imagine. It's hard to imagine that anybody could fall for it. But yet, there are literally millions of people who have.
Yeah. I went one time as a guest to a Pentecostal church where they talked in tongues, and I had no clue. It scared me because I thought they were going. I thought I was in one of those places where they bring out the snakes next, and I kind of eased over to. Honest to goodness, I moved over to the door, and I told Ricky the boy that took me over there, the Baptist kid, and I said, "This ain't quite my cup of tea. I'm gonna kind of stay over here because I really thought they're gonna bring out the snake's nest and we're all gonna have to grab a snake and I ain't gonna have nothing to do with this." So it, there's quite a group.
I love creating stories about snake handlers who die from it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he didn't have enough faith.
His faith wasn't strong enough.
No, he just had enough poison coursing through his blood.
Yeah. Well, I've caught a lot of snakes in my life, and I'm real careful with them. I certainly ain't going. And I know it ain't something to play with. So.
Yeah.
So we got
that.
That's
like when you lift up a brick and find a nest of copperheads.
Oh, well, copperheads.
I'd like to see them swim with box jellyfish down in Australia.
I'll kill you. I'll kill you quick.
Jump in there, buddy.
Just have
see what
faith.
You got. Of course, there's. Go ahead.
No, Larry. Now you got us eternal, and now you got us perfected. What's Bikurim going to do for us?
That's going to get us adopted into the family. I mean, that's how we're adopted. That's day three, and they always fall. Pesach, Matzah, and Bikurim. Just like that. So we got three set apart days.
Boy, now
what's
that's
that?
A big.
I said it's probably the best of all of them.
It is the best. I mean, because now you're part of the family for eternity. You get all the benefits of being part of the family. You live in the home. You get to play in this wonderful universe, plus the one he'll make later. Wow.
Yeah, well, you're a part owner. We're not just playing. We're a part owner. I mean, that's one of the things Dode pointed out. It's one of the things I love about Dode. He wasn't just saying, oh, I'm here to please you. Oh, how can I please you? Oh, it pleases me to please you, you know, like some kind of a parrot. He said, you know, I enjoy the benefits of this deal. You know what I mean? And there's nothing wrong with that.
There's some good stuff coming to me.
Yeah, I mean, this is a good thing. This is Tob. You know, and that's, you know, one of the words that make up Torah. It's Tob. It's good. And, you know, if somebody told me, you know, I think if anybody told the people who decided not to listen to Yahweh's words, if they knew that Yahweh was coming to meet them in 5 minutes or in 5 days, and you said, you know, that translation you have is 1,000 years newer than this translation, and here's what it really says. I'll bet you most of them at that point, knowing in very short order they were going to be standing in front of Yahweh, I'll bet their perspectives would change.
Now, why is it?
I mean, I remember a few years back, Patty was working at a daycare that was run, it was a Christian run and owned daycare, and yeah, there was a whole thing going around there. You know, if God showed up at your doorstep today and asked you to come with him, would you? And they were all talking about, well, I don't know if I could do it. And probably looked at them like they were stupid, like, really? If God's at my door and I know it's him and he says, come with me, I'm leaving.
That's Tarua.
But, you know, to
pal.
Them, the world is way more important than God. So I really don't know that if, you know, you put them in that situation, you know, God's coming and you gave them the chance, I still don't think most of them would bother.
Well, maybe you're right. You may be right. But wouldn't they at least seriously consider his words? I mean, we've already been over the fact that it's not our sacrifice of anything that gets us anything. But, you know, I know this about Yahweh. He doesn't expect much out of me, thankfully, because he doesn't get all that much. You know,
he expects the relationship. That's about it.
Yeah, but he expects me to seriously consider his words. You know, I mean, isn't that something we all have? Don't you? Obviously, I mean, we've done it every which way, to the base of the words, what the words mean.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what they mean in pictorial Hebrew.
That fiddle.
Yeah, these are important concepts, you know. But most people just haven't seriously even considered. They say they know them, but they have never listened to them, I guess.
A relationship with Yah is no different than a relationship with anyone else. It involves listening to them, understanding them, coming to know them, spending time with
reacting
them.
Reacting to those words.
That is a relationship. It's the same relationship I have with you, I have with Kirk, I have with Craig, I have with my wife. It's a relationship, and that's what Yah wants, is a relationship. Spend time with him. Listen to him. Understand what he has to say to you. Don't dismiss him.
Mm-hmm. You know, Terry was just saying to me, my wife, she was just saying that when we shared this finality of it all with a neighbor, and she found out that she would not go to hell, that seemed to be enough. She was less concerned about what she could get out of it and what she could gain from a relationship. She was just relieved that she was not going to go to hell, which is where we kind of started this conversation with the three options of what can happen versus the two that religion teaches. So I was kind of stunned by that. But I had another one as well that was very similar. I was talking to this girl who was her mother was Greek Orthodox and her daddy was Catholic. He was anti-Catholic in his older age, and when her parents had died and I presented this to her, she rejected just about everything I said, embracing Christianity. She had become like a Presbyterian, but she had, she told me she was relieved to know, I don't know how you reconcile all this, but she was relieved to know that her parents were not going to hell. Like
well, I mean, that's a good thing. That's a relief. I mean, that's
well, it
is. Relief.
It's not a punishment,
you know,
but I mean, I just thought I would have jumped on board with the other. I would say, well, if I know this and I know that, what's the choice here? I mean, what's keeping me from, you know, it's nice to know that your parents aren't, but I mean, I would have been, maybe I'm not making it clear. Maybe I can't explain it. Just,
no, you're making it clear. You would have stepped up to the plate and said, maybe I would want to live.
Show me the rest of the story. You know,
you're not going to hell. Okay, that's your choice. I don't see how you could make that choice. You know, it's laid out before me, and it's like, okay, I'm not going to go to hell. Yeah. Good, but wait, there's an option above this. Well, let's hear about this option.
Yeah, that's what I would do.
But if you can take, I'm not going to hell, and you want to walk away, okay, I'm not going to follow you. I'm not going to try and argue with you at that point, but, you know, I don't see how anyone could make that option, make that choice.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Yada makes a good point when he says that religious people are truly agnostic.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's right. They don't believe Yahweh's words. I mean, they put on an act that they do. They might want to pretend that they do.
They hope they do.
One of the conversations I had with one of Patty's sisters was, you know, talking about the whole three doors idea, and she was, her reaction was, well, if there's no, if people who aren't going to heaven don't go to hell, what incentive is there to come to know God? And I'm like, really?
Out of fear? What's the incentive?
Is that really fear? Your only incentive to know God is fear of hell. There's something wrong with you.
Well, Terry said to me one time when we were walking the dog, she said, you know, we were talking about this very subject, and she said to me, she said, you know, there's, and she's pretty intuitive about people, you know, her background and all this dealing with people and human resources. And she was saying, you know, there's a lot of people who would just be relieved to know they're not going to go to hell and wouldn't care squat about what God has to say. They would just be relieved to know that as long as I don't fight him or become religious, I could just shake, you know, they could just shake off their religion and everything else and just be, say, this is my life and I'm happy when when I die, if it's over, fine. And that's
well, you know, in the event, in the event there's somebody that listening that doesn't think we're correct here, I'm just going to refer to Revelations 20:13 and 14, and here's what it says.
Okay.
And the sea gave up and deposited the dead, necros in Greek, which were in it, and deceased and separated. And Hades gave up and deposited the dead, which were in them. They were evaluated, separated, and condemned. See, after this separation, there's another separation. Everyone according to their deeds. And this isn't doing good deeds. This is a matter of whether or not they misled others intentionally. Because here's what it says. And the separated and the spiritually dead and Hades were cast into the lake of fire, into this lake of judgment. This is the second separation and death, the lake of fire. And if anyone's name was not found written in the scroll of life, he was thrown in the lake of fire. This is a second death. Now, there are people that are not going to die there. And there are people that are going to get the eternal life, but their eternal life will be in separation there. Mm-hmm. So, they're, you know, those are the lucky ones that just, you know, have their souls annihilated, their consciousness dissipated.
Yeah.
And, you know, and going back to the whole idea of God not knowing everyone, those people like you were talking about, Kirk, that would be happy to just know they're not going to hell, God has no problem with them.
No.
You know, if that's
he said, if you don't want any part of me,
he's not bothered about it one way or the other.
No. I mean, that's the Buddhist thing. You just become part of the universe. Nothing. You become ultimate nothingness.
Yeah.
You know,
and you know, if you want to be nothing, God don't have a problem with you choosing that.
Yeah.
Now, you choose to lead others away from him, he has a big problem with that.
Mm-hmm. That's all pretty clear. Yeah. I was going to ask both of y'all, and Larry in particular, when to me it was so logical that when someone is talking about the Torah, and we have records that are, you know, 2,500 years old, 2,200 years old, the Dead Sea Scrolls and all, and we have some of the oldest manuscripts, even from the ones in Greek, they still have some, they found some of those in the first century. So when you're debating that this is what it actually says, to me it's illogical to go to the 1600s English libraries and dig out something some Englishman said to support a king in the King James or the King James Bible. I mean, to me, is what is there a debate to debate about when somebody's using the Dead Sea Scrolls versus somebody who's using modern Bibles? I don't understand why it's not a slam dunk.
Well, yeah, there's no debate to be had because if I show you what was originally written on any paper, and then I say, you know, 1,500 years later, 2,500 years later, it was changed to this. This is what you're reading, but this is what it actually said.
Yeah.
I mean, right then, you should feel like you've been had.
Yeah.
At least a little bit.
That should be your reaction. I mean,
you have to be pretty stupid to think that the text got corrected over time.
Yeah,
well, it was wrong then, but it's right now. That's not how things work. Things get changed over time. The farther back you go, the closer you're going to be to what was originally there.
And what I've discovered is the language was much simpler, too, and even the Hebrew. You can't even twist it because the letters are so plain, and then they changed the letters, of course, so they're not plain, and then they came up with the pointing system, which will pronounce it wrong, to also twist everything. I mean, but when you go
the
back,
Chauve system.
Yeah, but the further you go back, the plainer it is, the simpler it is. The more logical it is, it makes perfect sense. It doesn't contradict itself. I mean, and so to me, it's a total. I can trust this. And then, of course,
well,
you
yeah,
find
well,
the prophecy.
I mean, the story's straight from beginning to end. Ziploc perfect. It just is. You know, once you begin to understand that, you know, there's no omnipresent, it isn't heaven and hell, and, you know, it is the earth isn't 6,000 years old, and Adam wasn't the first man. He was the first man with Nisama. And you know, the flood wasn't worldwide, but it was regional. And, you know, once people begin to understand these things, now they're dealing in a realm of reality. Let's face it, as a religious person, you were not dealing in a realm of reality. You were dealing in a make-believe world where tradition trumped reality, where religion trumped reality, and things became surreal.
Mm-hmm. That's fair enough.
Wouldn't you say religion is pretty surrealistic? I mean, if you were going to make a painting about religion, it would have to be surrealistic, you know? I mean,
yeah, if Salvador Dali could do it, I couldn't do it.
Whoever. You know,
well,
anybody.
He's a surrealist. Yeah, he's a big surrealist guy.
Yeah, I know he's a surrealist. Oh, okay. I actually had a friend. They were the Dan Schilling that at a certain point in time that his PR man out of West Palm Beach was trying to make him the number one surreal painter in the world. And Dan's technique, of course, was much better than Dolly. But you know, it's you know, so much of that's political that you can't get around it.
Yeah,
you know. Matter of fact, they invited me to a party with Clint Eastwood one night. I couldn't make it, sadly. I really wanted to go to one of Clint's parties. Yeah, that was years ago, though. I don't care one way or another now.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, you know, here we sit, you know, with, you know, reality versus fantasy. And the thing that's always struck me the most is that the reality is far more amazing than the fantasy.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Now, we got eternity, we got perfection, and we got adoption. And then we have Shabuah, which is coming up pretty soon, too, which is obviously enlightenment and enrichment. So perhaps we ought to address
and
that a little bit.
Empowerment.
Empowerment.
It's empowerment. Very, you know, when, you know, the way Yada said that, you know, you're empowered times 10. He meant to the 10th power.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like going from a piece of paper to a human, you know, and then from a human to something where you're really not much more than a piece of paper, you know, all things considered. So you're being empowered exponentially, infinitely.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's an insane amount of power. I mean, really.
Well, yeah, it's unfathomable, actually, to me. I can kind of glimpse at it, but it's amazing beyond belief.
Well, you'd make Superman look weak.
Yeah.
I mean, that's for sure. You know, I mean, you take the Fantastic Four, the X-Men and Superman, and roll them all in one ball, they couldn't compete with you now.
Hmm.
I mean, that's an amazing concept, but it's a very real one if Yahweh's words are true.
Yeah.
And they're true because he proves them out. So I just, you know, so what we have, and I thought that was kind of an astounding find there. I remember when Yada first asked me, do you know why the first five were fulfilled? And I said, well, because the last three Moed Mekra are designed to, the fall Moed Mekra are designed to coincide with the fall of man, which is true.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's
but
true.
That's not
fair
why.
Enough.
Yeah, that was kind of an empty answer. I mean, the answer was the five benefits of the covenant are all
for Mikra.
Yes, and that's what really counted, and that's why they were done that way. And so, you know, once he said it, I thought, duh, you know, why didn't I think of that?
I've had those moments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He says something like, why did I not think of that before? That just seems so
right
obvious.
Because, yeah, that's the thing. It became obvious the second he said it. But it, you know, it's like the, you know, it's It's like something that, you know, it's like the snake that almost bit you, I guess. That's the best way to put it. But, yeah, those were fulfilled for a reason. And that's because everything that we need to be enriched and empowered and eternal and perfect, everything we need and be part of the family has been done with the fulfillment of the four Moed Mikra. Thus, to me, you know, if the story of Abraham's bosom is true, was true at that moment. I don't believe it would be true now.
No, I don't think it could be now.
Yeah. Right, and I'm not saying it wasn't true. Then there was a teaching there.
Yeah.
And one of the great teachings.
Yeah, it could have been a metaphor, but it's still, if it were literal, then it would not have been true now because everything has been fulfilled and the people who would benefit from it, who have accepted the covenant, everything had been done for them to, there would be no reason to wait somewhere. They could go off right now.
Right, there is no reason. That path has been blazed, and it was blazed by him and not me or you or them or anyone else that was waiting, but by him. And we can be thankful for that. But at the same time, you know, when you think of a place like Sheol, this waiting place, how would you like to be on the other side of that divide? And by the way, we were talking about Yahweh, you know, you're going to meet him in 5 days. Do you know, now that I've showed you this is what he really said, aren't you a little concerned when you're doing this over here? And I guess the answer to that, if that metaphor is true, the answer is you're right. They wouldn't do anything different. Because basically that's what happened there. Let me go up and at least tell my relatives. And say, what are you talking about? I sent Moshe, and they didn't listen to him. What?
They've got everything they need. What do you think you're going to do? What do you think I'm going to do?
Yeah, they
yeah, you're right.
That was actually
they wouldn't
one of the things
anything.
That really helped Patty, though, because she did struggle for a long time. Like I said, just before I met her, her father had passed away, and she struggled for a long time with the idea that she was never going to see her father again. But that story was really one of the ones that got her through that. It was like, you know, if he's not going to be in heaven, you know, he sure as hell don't want me to be where he's going to be. And That's the lesson of that story, you know. Think about the people that went before you, and no matter how much you loved and cared about them, if they're not in heaven, do you really think they want you with them, or do they want you to make the right choice and go be with Yahweh in heaven?
That's a good point. I would think the latter of the two. If they're anybody you really care about, they
if
probably
they
really
about
care
you,
about you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Kind of a quid pro quo. But that's, but these, you know, when we start taking these myths apart, heaven and hell, and it's all the nice things I do in my life and my pure thoughts that really get me to heaven because I believe in God. You know, nowhere in there does Yahweh say, believe in me and you're okay.
Or my name, yeah. Or my name if you knew it.
What he does, he said, trust in my name. The real
you got to know whose name is, who you're trusting in.
And something else that comes up a lot, you know, all of us look at the wall as an O, like in Torah, like in Shalom, you know, like in a Or, like in Goy, you know, I mean, it's the same Wa that he uses in his name. And since Yahweh was never trying to hide his name, he was constantly wanting to share it, according to his words. He was never trying to hide it. I had a guy tell me, well, gee, I'm glad you can give us the pronunciation because none of us know it. And I said, but you can say Shalom, but you can say Torah, you can say Or, you can say Goyim, and you can say Zachariah.
Every word that has a wa.
You can say Chawa, you can say Tarua, but you can't say Yahweh.
You can't pronounce that.
I said,
what's
going on there, pal? That's what I asked him. And he said, well, I think you're going to find you're going to be condemned. And I said, you know what? If I mispronounce Yahweh's words, or Yahweh's name, rather, nowhere in his words does he say that I am punished for that. No. Not anywhere.
Yeah.
Not once. It was the rabbis that said that. The rabbis said, you know, oh, you're going to use his name. Okay, we're going to judge you. And, you know, if they judged that you didn't pronounce the name correctly, you were killed.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Or if you brought it up, if you just said it, they would kill you.
Right.
Well,
yeah.
It got that bad, you know.
But yeah, well, it did. It got worse over time. But that's how they exalted themselves into the seat of authority and power, by making judgments like these. And his name, when they removed it, was a big, big, big part of that. And, of course, for that, he says they're all damned, right? They're all going to be eternally separated.
You know, you can't have a mystic type of religion where you're holding all the mysteries, you know, unless you can separate people out from the truth. So, you know, I understand their motive. I just can't understand how stupid that must have been. That I know how to read. I should have had enough sense to go, what's wrong with this? This ain't right.
Yeah, well, yeah, but once we see that, you know, you don't think about that when you're reading religious material. You know, it's right, JB. It says the Lord saith. Blah, blah, blah. And, of course, by the time, if you got this King James or the King's English, I don't even understand what most of those verses mean. I mean, I don't read Shakespeare.
I have the cliff notes for Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm the same guy. You know, I don't even
and
like
that's written a lot better than the King James Bible.
Yeah, but the point being, then once you start realizing, oh, all these names, a lot of this was the prophecy that they were going to remove his name. Mm-hmm. And then it happens. Okay, this all makes sense then. And when we're sitting there looking at his name, and whether I say Yahuwah, and I've heard people say Yahuwah, you know, I think it's Yahuwah, personally.
Well, it's an
O-W,
so, you know, it's an O-W sound, so you have a Yahuwah. Yahuwah. I mean, that's about as simple as you can make it. Yahuwah. Boy, that's close enough.
Yeah,
but I mean, if you say George and the French lady says George, nobody's going to get upset about it. She's still shouting out George.
Yeah, that's the best way to put it, because, you know, she didn't call him Sally.
No. I mean, and Yahuwah
sure
said they called my
name with horrible accents.
Yeah, just saying, I got a terrible accent too, so be it. But, you know, he ain't going to cut me out of the family because I can't speak very well. I mean, I'm comforted by Moshe.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say.
He
doesn't matter, right?
He didn't talk
to you. Oh, you silver tongued devil, you. Let me open the pearly gates. I mean, that's religion, isn't it? You know, I mean, he's just the best speaker. His delivery is so wonderful. Of course, you know, he's butchered everything Yahuwah ever said, twisted it, and, you know, has turned it into a
way
to make a living.
You just got to feel it. You have to feel it, you know. You're not supposed to know it, and you're supposed to feel it. Everything's supposed to be emotions.
That's right. We elect our politicians.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no one listens to
game show. I've always thought that a game show host should be the person doing those debates. Yeah, sure. Come on down. You know,
I vote for Bob Barker.
Why not? I mean,
you can't do any worse.
No, obviously you couldn't. You know, you couldn't do any worse than a controlled debate by the people that want to frame the argument.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you know, when you start looking for at Babylon for what it really is, you know, they're talking about the wrong things.
Mm-hmm.
We know that. They're talking about the wrong things. Mm-hmm. You know, if we wanted our land to be healed, we would lose the churches, get rid of all the religious buildings. There'd be 7 Moed Mikra, and our political leaders would be looking at the Torah.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
or they'd be resigning,
what the odds of that happening
are?
I mean, it's just not going to happen.
Yeah.
And that's why there is some hope for some few people, but there's no hope for the country as a whole, and there's no hope for the world as a whole, because that doesn't go on.
In your debates online, do you, because I'm just curious, have you brought up much Habakkuk or Chabouk.
Oh yeah, sure I have. Sure.
What's the reaction to that? I mean, that's, to me, that's a powerful prophecy. That just, boy, that blew me away.
Well, I mean, that's an astounding prophecy to use with agnostics, I think, more than anything, because I can tell you, the purveyors of the Christian religion have no interest in reading. They don't read, or they refuse to read, or they dig their heels in, or you know, what is this? What is this? Is what I get. What is it? You know, I don't get anybody, you know, saying, "Wow, that's an amazing prophecy."
Why
of course, my position is your position.
Yeah,
yeah, that's an astounding.
I mean, you should just go. I mean, it was like when he did the. Now I'm really up on Roman history, so there was only a few things in there that he had covered on areas of Roman history, certain years that I didn't really study very hard. So I was fascinated by the gaps that I missed. But when he did the thing on Syria and all with the twisted things that can only be because of steel girders and stuff like that, I mean, and then how he tied in the Roman with the the Roman Church, I mean, the Roman Empire never goes away. I mean, that, boy, those things, those three, and then following in with Chabouk, that was just blew me away. And I love prophecy. I mean, I always have. But those three just, you've got Syria end days, you've got Chabouk speaking, addressing Christianity and Paul specifically, and then you've got...
He talks about how he talks in circles, and that's exactly what Shimon said about him.
Yeah.
He seems to talk in circles around and about subjects.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but don't read his material because it's going to lead you to Torahlessness. And they throw that up. They throw that verse up as an endorsement of Paul. And by the way, if Shimon did endorse Paul, it wouldn't matter. It wouldn't matter because it would just tell us Shimon was confused, although he didn't. He openly opposed him. Because remember when Yahusha is talking, he said he could even fool you. And he was talking to the inner circle there. You know,
yeah, he was talking
to
right to Shimon. Yeah, Shimon Kevish, yeah.
He could even fool you.
Yeah.
So what if he did fool him?
So,
it wouldn't matter, would it? I mean, I wouldn't go with Yah's words. I wouldn't go with Peter's words or Shimon's words, rather. Go ahead.
If you never even read the witness writings, it would make no difference if you had the Torah. I mean, obviously it made no difference to everyone that came before it. I mean, they're wonderful to have some information. But, I mean, everything, when Yahweh says everything about the Torah is complete and everything is helpful and forever, and gosh, what else do you need to know? I mean, boy, when you throw these prophecies out, it just blows me away.
Well, let's see, that prophecy was going to be about a guy named Sheol that was going to lead Gentiles from all over the planet down a road, and he called him the plague of death.
Mm-hmm.
He said he'd be proud and puffed up. I mean, we've got over in, what is it, Corinthians, where Paul's saying that the Satan delivered
my
the thorn in
so
his side.
Satan has to keep it in check.
Yeah. Well, if you That's read it, sick. Satan's helping get Yahweh's words out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I believe that
is
one.
Insane. That's the satanic verses in Christianity. Yeah. We've got to write the satanic verses, too, and just put that on 100 pages and under it say, think about this. You know, I mean, I mean, really.
Go ahead.
Talks about he's going to be mired down in this poison, which is religion. That's what he calls it, his lover's house. His, you know, a house is always a religion. And then he says, on top of it all, he you know, being a braggadocious boob, all these people are going to meet really based on his sayings, you know. And it, by the way, his name's Sheol, and he's going to be there during the fulfillment of the Moed. And where was Paul? Paulos during, you know, I mean, he was in Jerusalem during the fulfillment of the Moed Mikra in 33 CE. He was in rabbi school. Wow. I mean, that fits everything to a T.
And if it's not him, who is it?
Right. There's only one man named Shaul.
Shaul or Shaul.
In the entire history of the world that fits that description. Only one man. Mm-hmm. And he described him perfectly.
And he describes himself as perverted and possessed by a demon.
I mean, come on. Hey, we can put that in satanic verses, too, when we write it. You know, we just keep putting those three verses or whatever over and over. You know, think about this.
Yeah.
You know, first, I think that one of the things that killed me about him is changing his name to Paulos, he who is lowly and little, and you're the chief spokesman now on the planet for Yahweh. I mean, the prophets, they had some pretty incredible names, you know.
And question this, or place of separation is my name. Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
Good choice. I remember JB when he first started doing Question and Paul, and I remember hearing JB on one of the shows, and the criteria was, of course, too, that they were going over what prophecies did Paul leave us with. You know, did he prophesy anything? And he obviously misquote, besides the fact that he doesn't quote anything that Yahusha says, he does have a little prophecy in there, and it's wrong. And JB pointed out, you know, if there's nothing else, if you do nothing else, if you don't examine another word after this, and JB rightfully said, you know, then you have to rule him out right away. Because he's wrong.
He said this harponzo was going to happen in his lifetime.
His lifetime, yeah. So if you made a list,
you examine what he wrote.
Yeah. So I mean, if you made a checklist, this guy is zero for 1,000 and counting. You know, how do you embrace this guy?
Yeah, I think that's why, that's a good point. That's why it's Jabba Wook. Embrace this,
yeah. You know, or choke on this is what he, you know. This guy named Paul. And he changes his name to a Roman.
That's an astounding prophecy, and what I've come to do is use it with agnostics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, along with the explanation of it, because it would be really hard to guess that this was going to happen from a guy named Shaul. Wouldn't it? It'd be.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a great guess that all that would happen,
yeah.
And it did.
Well, even Yadu says, I wrote down Question in Paul, which is really funny. You know, that's his name. You know, question this or question. You know, a place of question.
Yeah, right.
Question
him. Question him. Yeah, he should be questioned, and then to go from. Question him to he who is lowly and little.
Mm-hmm.
He who is lowly and little.
Paulos.
It's not
which
a lowly
happens
and little
to be
thing.
What Yahusha said, those who ignored the Torah and taught others to ignore it would be called.
Would be called.
Lowly and little.
Lowly and little.
And little. And it also happens to be how he described the horn that comes up to be the man opposed to the Torah.
Yeah. Good point.
Lowly and little. Lowly and little. That's what he says. And you know, that. And of course, that's where you know. And you know, because it didn't get by Yada, and we can see it, and I can see it pretty clearly, that he's, you know, Paul was the archetype.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to be a guy full of faith and grace and embracing and loving everything other than women.
Except
and that's in Chabawook, too. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the Torah. Yeah, of course, nobody could hate women if they embraced the Torah. Couldn't be done. Am I right? I mean,
okay.
That's the Ruach right there. You know, I mean, there's just no way to attack women.
Or you can't attack family.
You don't want
to bust up family, so.
Well,
yeah,
it looks
and I've
like
never seen
the end of the recording.
Without a woman.
We're no longer live.
Okay.
Well, oh,
still
darn.
But we're no longer live. We're at the end of the 2 hours, so.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to run and have some dinner. And
I was going to say, my wife's making some parm, and it smells delicious.
Yeah.
So
okay. Well, I've enjoyed it. I'm waiting for y'all to get on back, but it's been fun the last couple of weeks. I thank you both for allowing me to be part of it. I enjoyed it very
much. Glad I was able to participate this time.
Okie dokie. Take care, Larry, and take care, JB. We'll see you later. Okay?
All right, thanks. You guys have a good weekend.
See you guys next
week.
You
too.
You, Dave.
All right. Bye-bye.